My name is Larry Kluger. I'm a member of the board of Pardes, the Institute for Jewish Studies in Jerusalem, Israel. This podcast will feature Rabbi Daniel Landis, the director and Rosh Yeshiva of the Pardes Institute. Materials are available for this podcast, several sheets of handouts. They are optional. If you can print them out, they will be of help. You can find them on our website, www.pardes.org.il/podcast. So welcome, Rabbi Daniel Landis. Here we go.
Thank you very much, Larry. It's a pleasure to be learning with you this session, our first session of Torah study and the podcast. My topic today is a well-known story, kind of controversial story, from the Talmud Menachot, which we've entitled The Rabbi and the Prostitute. I need to tell you that a few years ago, when I developed this shiur, this class, I was asked by a beloved aunt of mine what I was planning to teach that day, and I, without batting an eye, I said to her, auntie, I'm teaching about the rabbi and the prostitute. She said, oh, you mean Rabbi Goldfarb? Well, be as it may, we won't go into his private life, but let me take you into this story. But prior to the story, let me say a word about Agadah. Agadah really comes from the word, as you know, lahagid, to tell. Agadah is a form of telling. It's a form of midrash. It's a form of seeking out of creative ways of understanding a biblical verse. And here in this type of Agadah, Midrash Agadah, that we have, it's actually a classic story form, which in a sense is nonetheless is a comment on the verse. The verse in question is the verse that is said liturgically, from the paragraph that says liturgically, as part of our Shema service. That is part of the morning service and part of the evening service. And there, in discussing about the mitzvah of tzitzit, those ritual fringes that should be on the corner of the garments, it says, V'hayalachem l'tzitzit, uritem oto, zchartem et kol mitzvot Adonai v'asitem otam. That you these fringes should be for you for tzitzit, that's the name. You shall see them. You shall remember all the mitzvot, all the commandments of the Lord, and you shall do them. And the verse continues, V'lo tatu achrei levavachem v'achrei nechem asher etem zonim achareyem. And you should not go astray, or you should not explore after your hearts and after your eyes, in which you have a, and I'm putting in the word, tendency, in which you have a tendency to go astray after your heart and after your eyes. Zonim, but the literal translation, which you really won't find usually in your Siddur, for zonim comes from the word zonah. Zonah is prostitute. So we are warned here in the biblical verse that we should not go not merely astray, we shouldn't go a-whoring after our eyes. And that's a pretty blunt way of looking at it. But at Pardes, we're looking for pshat, and that's really the pshat of the verse. That's really the plain meaning. Every midrash, every creative explication is based on a radical formation of pshat. It takes the word not only contextually, but the word literally. Having said that, on with the story. And I'll read the story in the English, and I certainly, with some references to the Hebrew, for the Hebrew and the Aramaic, and I really suggest that you take a look at the, if you can, at the material, at the text that you can receive online. But nonetheless, I'll give you enough information here. There's a story, Maase, story of a man who was very scrupulous about the command to wear fringes, tzitzit, on his garments. Nevertheless, when he heard of a certain courtesan in one of the cities across the sea who charged 400 gold dinars as her fee, he sent her 400 gold dinars, and she fixed an appointment for him. When his time arrived, he came and sat down at the entrance to her house. her maidservant went in and told her, that man, who's from across the sea, who sent you 400 gold dinars, has come. And he's sitting there at the entrance to your house. The courtesan replied, let him come in. After he came in, she prepared 7 beds for him, one being above the other, 6 with silver bedsheets, and 1 with gold. Between one bed and the next, there was a silver ladder, but the last ladder was made of gold. She disrobed, climbed up to the uppermost bed, sat down, nude, upon it, and he too disrobed and went after her to sit across from her. Beginning of the story. The first third of the story, the setup. And actually for us, it's a pretty shocking story. If we were looking for a genre, a literary way of describing this, we'd say this is kind of a voyeurist fiction. We're looking out at two individuals we don't know personally. We don't even know their names. They're anonymous to us. We can make some assumptions about them. They're both extremely capable. This is a man who has money. This is a man who can order what he wants. A man who has discretion. He goes astray, but he doesn't do it in his own home. He goes across the sea. She is clearly very capable of what she does. She orders her maidservant. She accepts appointments. She prepares a moment of luxury. They're really in a place of a transaction. They both know what they want. They both know what they assuming the story, we were inside the story, we're assuming that not only is it what they want, but somehow this is what they need for themselves. There's no friction, no problem between themselves. And there's a readiness to begin this night of ecstasy. Indeed, 7 is a magical number for us. And this 7 as a magical number always refers to a perfection. It's interesting that there is a version of the story which, under Roman influence, says that there are 8 beds, because 8 within classical culture was the sign of perfection. But within Jewish culture, 7 is one of perfection, and this version of the story has 7. But we do note a certain problem with this individual. The story of a man who was very scrupulous about the commandment to wear tzitzit on his garments. Is this man a hypocrite? We could perhaps think so. Here he is. He places himself as a religious individual. He wears the ritual fringes. One can conjure up an image of him dressed well and dressed religiously, with the fringes floating out and having the appearance of a religious person. And here he's doing something which, by all accounts, of one's own identity, of one's spirituality, not to mention the morality, is something which is contradictory. And therefore, hypocrisy is the word that comes to mind. But I think that is not doing justice not only to this anonymous individual, but to the power of the story. We're talking about a person who evidently is in conflict. It says here, wear the tzitzit, we saw in the verse in the Bible, wear the tzitzit, and somehow this will help you to remember the mitzvot and not to go astray, not to go a-whoring. But he goes a-whoring. He wears the tzitzit, but it's to no avail. He's a person who's really in deep self-conflict, even though he's a person of great ability, of great majesty, the person who gets what he wants. In fact, this may be also a source of the contradiction. So we just see the two of them. We don't know their innermost thinking. We see contradictions within himself. With her, we see no contradiction. And they're prepared. Look how the story changes. She also, the story continues. But just then, we had left off, that he too disrobed and went up after her to sit across from her. She had disrobed, she had climbed up to the uttermost bed, she had sat upon a nude, and now, as we had said, he too disrobes and he goes after her to sit across from her. The assumption here is they have gone from ladder to ladder, from bed to bed. They've gone to the highest potential point of ecstasy. The story evokes it. The story doesn't describe it in detail. Biblical stories, rabbinic stories are evocative, but they're never, and sometimes erotic, but they're never pornographic. And then the story continues. But just then, the four fringes of the garment that he still wore struck him across his face, whereupon he let himself slide off until he sat on the ground. She also slid off until she sat on the ground. And she said, but let me interrupt. What happened? All of a sudden, the four fringes of the one last garment he's still wearing strikes him across the face. If we're talking about literary genres, this becomes a Stephen King science fiction story. Then all of a sudden, as he's about to consummate his night of ecstasy, the tzitzit are slapping him and are hitting him. That could very well be so. It has elements here of strangeness. Actually, if I was thinking of literary genres, try this. It sounds more like a farce. Here he comes. He's looking good. He has prepared everything that he wants to prepare. And now he's slipping. He's entangled in a tzitzit. He's gone from being the Brad Pitt hero to being the Woody Allen schlemazel. He's tripping upon himself. And why? What is it that he's still wearing his tzitzit? But we know this is the truth. We know that people bring to encounters, they bring themselves, they bring their baggage, they bring their conflicts, they bring everything that is themselves. Of course, he's slipping on his tzitzis. Of course, he's tripping over it, whether the real tzitzis or whether the metaphorical tzitzis. He's tripping and he's flailing from those deep-set conflicts that he has within himself. He has an obsession. At the same time, he has a spirituality. It says here in the story that after the tzitzis has struck him, after he's caught up in his own conflict, after he's falling, he lets himself slide off from the seventh bed to the sixth, to the fifth, to the fourth, to the third, to the second, and to the first until he sits on the ground. And for us who understand, those of us who are learning at this point, we understand the symbolism, what it means to sit on the ground. He's below the level where he started. Sitting on the ground is always a symbol of mourning. It's a symbol of mourning because sitting on the ground is a symbol of defeat. You sit on the ground when you're mourning a beloved one, or you sit on the ground on Tisha B'Av, on the ninth day of Av, when you mourn the destruction of the temple because you're in a point of defeat, and here this man has felt his defeat. The embarrassment of what had happened to him when he could not perform, and the real reason for the ability not to perform because the fact that his conflict is exposed. What's interesting here is she also slid off, the story continues, until she sat upon the ground and she said, "By the Roman eagle, I will not let you be until you tell me what blemish you saw in me, what pagam, what blemish you saw in me." And he replies, "By the temple, never have I seen a woman as beautiful as you. But there's one precept that the Lord our God has commanded us called tzitzit, fringes. With regard to it, the Lord has said, I am the Lord your God, and that is written twice in the scripture, signifying, quote, I am he will exact punishment, and I am he will give reward. I am the Lord is to say that there's a reward for your restraint in life, and there's a punishment when in a inappropriate way, you exceed your bounds. And just now, the four fringes of the tzitzit," he continues, "these four fringes of the tzitzit seem to me like four witnesses ready to testify against me." She says to him, "I will not let you be until you tell me your name, the name of your town, the name of your teacher, and the name of your school in which you study Torah." He wrote all this down, and he gave the script to her. So ends the second part of the story. It's a fascinating change. We've gone from a very cool, voyeuristic account, so cool that we're disturbed by it because we see some of the conflicts. We move to the second section that we once entertained may be science fiction, but more sounds like farce. But now when they've slid to the ground, this really has entered personal tragedy. She slides to the ground also. They both have not put on their clothes, but there's nothing erotic about this encounter. In fact, for the first time, they speak to each other, and they really speak to each other. They communicate to each other. She swears by all that is holy in her life by the Roman eagle, the symbol of power. And in her life, her beauty was her power. And the Roman courtesan had a great standing within Roman society. And he, even though he's been off the reservation, he's not been such a loyal Torah man at this moment, but he still swears by what he really deep down considers holy, by the temple. He swears by the avodah, the temple service. He says that she's beautiful and that she has no blemish, that the blemish is within him, that he's been contradicting this Torah that he really believes in. There's this moment, and I emphasize this, it's the moment of defeat. It's this moment of tragedy, personal tragedy. I say personal tragedy for him is apparent. What about for her? Well, it hit a moment. It hit a core. Can we speculate that her fear now is realized, her fear about the day when she will lose her beauty? Has the moment arrived? Has she now lost her power over people? She swears by the Roman eagle. Has the Roman eagle now begun to leave the perch that it assumed metaphorically over her bed, in which she had the power of her beauty? She's also in a fragile situation. They meet in his very real defeat, and at the moment of her envisaged defeat, her future life, and they speak to each other. And he confesses to her, because she really asks. And then she does something which, under normal circumstances, he would avoid at all costs. She says, I won't let you go until you tell me your name, your real name. You're no longer John Doe. Which town you came from. Who is your teacher? Because I know that you come from one of the schools of wisdom. And the name of your school, what is that particular academy, yeshiva, that you studied your holy law in? And everything that he would have resisted about confessing exactly who he is, well, he's now able to confess because he's confessed the real truth, that he lives in a certain conflict. He wrote all this down and gave the script to her. There's great artistry in the story because as he writes it down, and think about the image of him writing down all this information and the camera as we're filming it right now, you and I, we're filming it right now. The camera of pans, we watch him write, and he writes down this information, but we don't see the information ourselves. He closes the piece of paper, of parchment, and when he hands it to her, he puts it into her hand, she's able to see it, but we never see it. The Talmud here preserves his anonymity at the same time that he's given his full disclosure to her. He discloses himself to her. He discloses his true self to her because he trusts her. It's as if the Talmud trusts her much more than it trusts us, the reader. He writes all this down. He gives a script to her. Think about this act of trust and commitment. It's always an inexplicable moment. How do you find who's the other person you trust? There's never any guarantee of that. There's never any moment in which you know for sure that the other person is trustworthy. But it's a commitment in moment. It's commitment in time. It's commitment to the other person. He writes it down. He gives a script to her. Just like thousands of years later, a Hasid will give what he writes, his innermost thoughts, in a little kvittel, in a little piece of paper that he writes and he gives to his Rebbe, to his Hasidic master. Or we, when we visit Israel, we'll write it down, and we go to Yerushalayim, we write down our innermost feelings, and we go up to a stone wall, and we place it within the cracks of the wall because we can commit to that process, and we commit ourselves. This is what's happened. Let's look at the third part. At that, she arose and divided her possessions into three parts. A third for the government, a third for the poor, and a third she took with her in her hands. And the aforementioned bedsheets, however, she retained for herself. She then came, she traveled, to the study house of Rabbi Chiya, and said to him, Master, direct your disciples to make me a proselyte. I wish to convert. My daughter, he replied, Rabbi Chiya replies, perhaps you've set your eyes on one of the disciples. She took out the script, the piece of paper, and she hands it over to Rabbi Chiya. He looks at it. Go, he says. Go and acquire the husband that you deserve. What happens here at this story? The story becomes completely her story. And this is an amazing turn for a rabbinic story. The heroine becomes the Roman courtesan. She's the heroine of the story. She takes the script of paper, she puts it in her pocket, and she changes her life. She sells off all her possessions, a third for the government because she has to pay off the government. She's a source of tax, she's a source of revenue. She's a person who may have a position within society that's a derivative position. She pays off the police, she pays off the politicians, she's able to get out of town. A third of the money she gives to the poor. I take this really as her real conversionary move. She moves from power to service. She moves from the Roman eagle to the temple service, and the replacement in our lives, according to the rabbis, for the temple service are acts of charity, and this is what she does. This is not a Roman act. And a third of the money she takes for herself. She does not become a poor person. She goes to the study house, she makes the travel, she goes over the sea, and now we know it's the house of Rabbi Chiya. We can speak at length of Rabbi Chiya, but we just say this. Rabbi Chiya is not one of those warm, fuzzy rabbis. He's not one of those who meet you at the entrance with a entrance to the door with a guitar and a warm hug. Rabbi Chiya was a very stern taskmaster. I would imagine if she comes in as we paint this picture for our eyes or as we film it for ourselves, that she comes in dressed modestly. But nonetheless, it's clear that a strikingly beautiful woman, even her simple clothes, her simple accessories, the way she walks, and the way she presents herself, it is clear that when she says that she wishes to be the convert, that there's a special story behind it. And Rabbi Chiya doesn't mince any words. He zooms in a dagger-like response and says, you came here for one of my students? Maybe he knew which student it was. That's possible. And we can't deny that. We ourselves don't know what Rabbi Chiya knows, but we ourselves can see what Rabbi Chiya saw. And what does she do? She brings them in to this kind of conspiracy of commitment. She gives them the secret. She takes the risk, a risk for her intended one, and the risk for her own future happiness. She doesn't lie. He reads this, and he says, maybe this man has really found, in the most unlikely of all places, the most unlikely of all people, he's found the proper match for him. She's transformed herself. Perhaps he will transform himself with her. And in fact, he says to her a line, which is actually a line that's normally a very male line. And that's, you know, the line that you give to a man, go acquire, the notion of acquisition, which sounds very harsh in contemporary language, but has in Jewish legal theory, refers to the acquisition of responsibilities, but nonetheless has always been directed from male to female. And here it's reversed. As part of the artistry of the story and part of the significance, she has acquired him because she's paid the price. She's changed her life. She's undergone an amazing transformation. She's given up a lot. We all hope that it will be worthwhile for her, and we have a confidence in that. Go, he says. Go, you deserve the husband you're about to acquire. Acquire the husband that you certainly deserve. And that becomes a story. But there's an epilogue to the story. An epilogue is this. Before long, those same bedsheets she had laid out for him for an unlawful purpose, she was able to lay out for him for a lawful purpose. In Hebrew, it's much shorter. Oton matzaot, shitzia lo be'isur, shitzia lo be'heter. The bed sheets that she had laid out for something which was forbidden is now laid out for something which is permissible. To explain this, just think if this was not a Jewish story. If this, however, was a story of one of the other great religions, if this was a Christian story, if this was a Christian story, then, and there are stories in Christianity that are somewhat like this, but the endings are always different. In the end, she transforms her life, but she takes a vow of poverty and of chastity, and she goes out to a nunnery where she lives out her life, and he, in the same way, also undergoes some sufferings, turns his life around, and becomes a member of a monastery, and perhaps at the end of their lives, 50 years later, they exchange a letter, or the story is told from a niece of one to the nephew of the other. Because, after all, within that religious structure, the absoluteness of chastity and the absoluteness of poverty assures purity. There are even Asian stories of that great religious culture, which the two of them recognize the futility of what they are doing, and they leave this world, as it were, and go to a more pure state. But this is a Jewish story. In a Jewish story talks about transcendence, talks about the idea of going beyond, of transforming oneself. The Jewish transcendence is interesting. You schlep along with you, you drag along with you this life. And the real case is not to leave everything behind, but to transform it. She brings the very same bed sheets with her. She's transformed her life so not that her life shall be denied, but the life will be enhanced. The purity of life is not the rejection of life, but the purity of life is the purification of life, in which they can find a way of meeting. They meet, they've met in tragedy, real meeting in tragedy. Now they meet in happiness. They meet in commitment. They meet in privacy. And actually, that's where the story ends, because we don't know about the rest of their lives. The actual sexual description, of course, is not given. This is now the time for themselves. And the Jewish story and the story from the Talmud of Menachot, which is a story that talks, which is part of the tractate that talks about sacrifices and talks about gifts ends. It's a story about reversal. It's a story about change. It's a story about shame. And it's a story about a man finding himself and a woman finding herself. They find themselves through commitment, and they find themselves in that commitment to be elevated. It was wonderful studying and learning with you. I am sure that you may have different takes on this story. The Pardes way is to present certain ideas and to find out the other ideas, and we look forward to hearing from you. Just go online with Pardes and let us hear what you have to tell us about your take on the story. Shalom uvracha.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Landis, and thank all of you for listening and for your participation. As Rabbi Landis referred, we would very much like to hear from you. Please email us at podcast@pardesusa.org. PardesUSA.org. That's podcast@pardesusa.org. We'd like to know how you learned about this podcast. What were you doing while listening to it? Were you in your office, in your home, on the streets, in the gym? And any other comments? Thank you so much, and goodbye.